it might take, years or decades to become, an expert like in a whole field, and you might be very far from that, but it really doesn't take that long to become the world expert on one particular tiny little problem, right? And, so try to, become the world expert on something, even something very, very narrow.
So Professor Aronson, can you tell us a bit about your early journey? You were a young prodigy. You graduated high school at the age of 15, got your PhD at 22. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I didn't really graduate high school when I was 15. I got a GED from New York State. But I was not happy in high school for several reasons. I mean, just socially, academically, and I wanted to get out. And I was in a weird situation because I went to public school in the U.S. for junior high, and then in Pennsylvania actually, and then my parents moved to Hong. I lived in Hong Kong for 1 year because my dad was working there, and because of the I went to an American international school there, but because of a mismatch between the way they did things in the U.S. and in Hong Kong. I was not able to do math that was appropriate, I guess. I had always been sort of ahead in math, and so the only way to deal with that was for me to skip a grade and skip and go to the high school. And once I had done that, that was sort of a something flipped for me, right? That I could actually do this. I could get out of this environment. Where I really wanted to be was college, right? I wanted to be in a place where of course, I somewhat had an idealistic view of what college was, but a place where ideas would matter more than popularity, and you would be able to choose what to study and advance at your own pace, and all of these wonderful things. So then I returned from Hong Kong to the U.S. and was in a public high school for a year. And as I said, I didn't like it. And then I ran out of math to take. Right, I took the AP calculus, and then my parents basically suggested to the school, why doesn't he just do online learning, right, and do like differential equations or whatever with the Stanford has this EPGY program, right, where you can do these things. And and, my parents said they would pay for it. The school said no. So I sort of seized on that as my excuse. I think I had just seen a brochure for a place called the Clarkson School in upstate New York, which is a part of Clarkson University, but you can live there for a year and take college courses. It's for high school students, right? I said, even knowing very little about this, I think, I want to give this a try. And my parents, allowed me to do that. I think, we had the car all, packed up to drive there. And while, when we were about to leave, then finally, there was one, actually math teacher at my old high school who was very, very good and who was, trying to advocate for me. And he was like, okay, guess what? I just got it so that Scott can take the EPGY program. And we said, too late, sorry. So I went to Clarkson, and I generally had a very good experience there. I mean, socially, there were a lot of the same problems as at high school, but I was able to take courses that were a lot more interesting. I was able to sort of meet professors, get started doing research, and you apply from the idea is that after a year at this Clarkson program, then you apply to colleges as a freshman, but with a year of college credit. So I did that. I was very disappointed at the time at how things turned out, because I got rejected from almost every college that I applied to. I had a very weird background, but I was lucky that Cornell and Carnegie Mellon were kind enough to accept me. And so I decided to go to Cornell. But then there was one problem, that they required a high school diploma before you could enroll there, which I didn't have. And so we realized that I needed a GED from, my old high school, oftentimes one's old high school will just give you a diploma after you've gone to Clarkson. My high school would not do that, because they said I was missing phys ed. I would have to, spend the summer doing phys ed. But, and then New York State said, we can't give him a GED because you have to be 17 to have a GED, and he's 15. My mom eventually convinced them to make an exception and give me a GED. So then I went to Cornell. I mean, I've met other people who were homeschooled, who actually did things that were more radical than what I did. I mean, I was accelerated by 3 years. That was all. And then after I was in college, I didn't really accelerate anymore, because, I felt like I was, in an environment, where I wanted to be. And, from now on, the main limitations were internal. They were no longer external.
Hmm. Was it intimidating being in classes with people 3 or 4 years older than you?
The truth is, I would say the majority of them didn't even know that I was younger. If they knew, it was, maybe an oddity a little bit, but then they didn't care that much, right? I mean, because, it's not like I was a 10-year-old, right? I was, by the time I started at Cornell, I was 16 by then. And, I feel like academically it was fine. I mean, the main issue was social, right? I mean, and my parents had warned me that, if to skip grades is going to completely screw up my social life, and, it's going to make dating, incredibly difficult, and so on and so on. And I sort of brushed all of that aside, and of course that all turned out to be true. I got my PhD before I learned how to drive, really, or learned how to have any kind of a social life, to speak of. I mean, or any kind of a dating life, really. I did things in a weird order, you could say, and that did cause an enormous amount of stress for me. But my main argument was that, I was already socially unhappy in high school, right? I was already mm-hmm. miserable, without having skipped grades, and so I felt like, as long as I'm going to be miserable socially anyway, as it seemed at the time, I would be, at least I could be learning stuff, at least the mm. academics could be better.
Yeah. And as far as the academics go, what were the advantages and disadvantages of specializing so early?
Well, I mean, I don't get to rerun my life multiple times and compare. But I think that, mainly I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to sort of learn about stuff that interested me, right? And it was not it was not just, you know, that, you know, I wanted to take only math and CS and nothing else, right? It was not like that. I mean, I took, you know, plenty of humanities in college, right? And, but, you know, I wanted to sort of have some freedom to, you know, I pick what to learn about, right? I mean, like in high school, you know, humanities means, you know, the five paragraph essay, right? It means, you know, you basically have to regurgitate what the teacher wants from you, right? And, you know, if you try to, you know, do your own thing, write things in your own way, then you will actually fail, right? And, you know, this is, I learned this from experience, you know, this is not theoretical, right? You know, so even the humanities, right, I was a lot happier with in college than I was in high school. So it wasn't just a matter of specialization, but partly it was. I mean, I think that by the age of 16 or so, I knew what I was passionate about. It was the fundamentals of computing, right, and understanding what computers could or couldn't do. And I was ready to be learning about that and working on it. And, you know, I think that there is, you know, the entire concept of, you know, of sort of teenagerhood, right? That like people are, you know, from the age of 12 to 18 or now maybe even 20 or so are still basically children, right? I think that that's largely a modern construction, right? Huh. If you go back even a few hundred years, you know, by the time someone is a teenager, they're an apprentice, right? They can work, you know, they can be learning while they're also, you know, working, or they can be learning, you know, the trade that they choose. And so I think that's actually natural, right? I don't feel like I'm that unusual in that respect. I think, you know, I mean, you know, maybe, you know, unusual in some respects, but not in wanting to sort of get started with life when, you know, I was 15 or 16.
Yeah, I had Tyler Cowen on the podcast, and he started, he knew he wanted to be an economics professor basically in his early teens, and he was reading and preparing for that from that time on.
Economics professor is not what, you know, one often thinks of as like a child, you know, or an adolescent realizing that they won, but that is in the case of Tyler Cowen, I could easily believe that.
Is there some special advantage of learning the fundamentals of the field you know you're going to go into early on? So instead of, except for the fact that you just get more years to accumulate knowledge, is there the special advantage of learning it in your early years?
You know, I'm not sure. It's a very interesting question. I mean, you know, one could imagine that, you know, while someone's brain is still developing, right, that it's good to be exposed to certain things at that age. And, you know, I mean, like we know examples that are like this, right? Like, you know, an obvious one would be learning languages, right? Where, you know, there's a window where, you know, children can just soak up languages, you know, like a sponge. And, you know, after that window, you can learn a language, but it will be a difficult, you know, intellectual puzzle, and you'll never speak it as well as a native 5-year-old will speak it, right? Yeah. So it could be like that, but it could also be that you know, like our brains are not really adapted for learning any of this stuff, right? I mean, like, you know, when we get to, you know, theoretical physics, theoretical computer science, and so on, right? You know, all of it is like, you know, learning a language that we don't natively speak, right? And on that model, it would just be a question of getting a head start of you know, of how much time you have to spend on it. I would love for someone to research that question, because I don't know the answer.
I have heard, as you know, like many of the important discoveries in quantum mechanics were made by people who at the time were very young, right? And that's an interesting fact. Not only did they learn that stuff early on, but like they made those contributions early on.
Yeah, but that's not just quantum mechanics. I mean, that's all over, you know, math and physics, right? There are, I mean, Newton was, you know, about 22, mm-hmm. right, when he, you know, had his miracle year, you know, of inventing calculus, you know, discovering the laws of mechanics. Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, you know, by I'm already old by the standards of math and physics, right? You know, the you know, which is weird to think about, but you know, there are also many examples of you know, great contributions that were made by people in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, so that's another empirical question that I wonder about, right? Is it that people's brains actually slow down as they get older, or is it simply that they have less motivation or less free time, right? I mean, like in my case, you know, having two kids, you know, clearly given me enormously less time for research, right? And you know, like in those cases where I'm, you know, traveling, where I'm, you know, away from the kids for a week, you know, maybe like I can work again, and it sudden, you know, it feels a lot like it did when I was in my 20s, right? And so, then there's also the issue of motivation, right? That like when I was before I was established, you know, like my entire conception of myself, you know, my entire like goals for my life were wrapped up in, you know, succeeding in research, you know, and doing whatever it took. And now, you know, it's more like, you know, I have all kinds of other concerns. I have my own students to worry about, you know, my postdocs, my kids, of course, my blog, you know, the popular things I write. And, you know, research just feels like one more thing that I do, right, that my identity is not as much wrapped up in. So, you know, I may have also gotten dumber, right? That's certainly possible, right? But, you know, it's hard to disentangle from those other factors.
Yeah, you're the third person, and I promise we'll get to the technical questions eventually, but you're the third person on the podcast I'm about to ask this question because it fascinates me. Miracle years, as you mentioned, it's not just that, you know, people make like very important discoveries at young ages, but they make lots of seemingly uncorrelated important discoveries at young ages. So as you know, like Einstein did Brownian motion, special relativity, what was the third one? There were two or three more.
There was the photoelectric
effect. Yeah, that's right. And these don't seem, superficially at least, to be related. And yet it's interesting they happen in the same year. But what do you think explains that phenomenon?
In the case of Einstein, I mean, you know, you're asking me to explain Einstein's miracle year. I mean, that's a tall order. I mean, one can say certain things, like, you know, one can say that, you know, physics in the early 20th century was ripe for these, you know, for these interrelated revolutions, right, of relativity and quantum mechanics, right? You know, I mean, you know, if it wasn't Einstein, it would have been someone else, you know, not long after, with all of those things. General relativity, which, you know, which took Einstein a decade longer, you know, that was the one thing where if it hadn't been for Einstein, then, you know, it for all we know, it might have been decades before anyone else did that. But, you know, the stuff that he did in his in 1905, I mean, you know, they were all things that physics was kind of ripe for. Maybe it took, you know, one person just looking at things in a sufficiently different way. You know, I'm not sure really, but also it might be, you know, the confluence of all of those things is part of why, you know, we think of Einstein as Einstein. Right. You know, there were many other great physicists, you know, around the same time, you know, who may have done, you know, one or two things of that caliber. Right. But only Einstein does, right. does three or four of them.
I'm glad you brought up the topic of like ideas being in the air and ready to pluck, because this leads me directly to the next question. I was rereading the lecture notes from your quantum information science class, and there's the lecture on quantum teleportation. And you were answering, how do people figure this kind of stuff out? And you say, it's worth pointing out that quantum mechanics was discovered in 1926, and that quantum teleportation was only discovered in the 90s. And of course, quantum computing, I'm a big fan of David Deutsch, and he discovered it, or he thought of it, in the 80s. It seems like these ideas were ready to pluck you know, back when quantum mechanics was developed, why did it take so long to have these ideas plucked?
Yeah, that's an extremely interesting question. I mean, you know, the whole idea of thinking about quantum entanglement, you know, and not as something like metaphysically weird or you know, spooky or basically how do we explain this away? How do we get rid of this? But in terms of how do we use it, right? How do we use it for, you know, to improve information processing, right? I think that's a point of view that, as far as I know, really only started with John Bell in the 1960s, right? With you know, Bell having this remarkable insight that you know you could do this experiment to test the prediction of entanglement and distinguish it from any possible theory involving, you know, local hidden variables, right? And then a little bit later, Stephen Wiesner, you know, had the idea of quantum money, right? Or using the uncertainty principle for cryptography. Although he was not able to publish that until the 80s. And, you know, there are a few things that I could say here. I mean, one is that when quantum mechanics was discovered in the 20s, it was not at all clear to the people who discovered it that this was sort of a final form that the laws of physics would take, right? You know, they thought, you know, I mean, that there was a large contingent that thought that, you know, this is some, you know, scheme that sort of represents our current knowledge. But, you know, but clearly one, you know, what one has to improve on it, right? And then that, I mean, that was very much Einstein's point of view, for example, and I think also Schrodinger's. You know, like Bohr and Heisenberg, you know, they were very much, you know, opposed to looking for something beyond quantum mechanics, but sort of not, you know, they sort of not in a way that was sort of, you know, inspiring more research about what you could do with quantum mechanics, right? They just wanted everyone to just sort of shut up and stop asking about these things, right? So you could say, you know, even though Bohr was right and Einstein was wrong on the issue of local hidden variables, you know, there's a deeper sense in which, you know, Einstein was the more right one and sort of putting his finger on, you know, there is something here that we do not yet understand and that we need to understand, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, indeed, you know, that, I'm sorry, that thing would not be understood really until the discovery of the Bell inequality in the 60s. The other you know, issue is that when quantum mechanics was discovered and into the 30s, you know, there was so much to do in terms of, you know, figuring out how chemistry works, right? Just applying quantum mechanics to understanding the real world around us. Right. And you could say on the other side in computer science, you know, for God's sakes, the entire notion of a universal computer was just being born. Right. The whole field of classical computing was only just being born. Right. So there was sort of so much, you know, on the plates of both sides that it might have seemed wildly premature to anyone to combine the two. Right. And then. Of course, World War II, you know, intervened the people who were doing fundamental science, a lot of them went to work, you know, either at the Manhattan Project or Bletchley Park. And, you know, and then after that, I mean, I think the theoretical physicists were very focused on just, you know, this zoo of new particles that were being discovered and in formulating quantum field theory. You know, it was very, very much out of fashion for decades to think about the, you know, the fundamentals of quantum mechanics itself. And, you know, in the meantime, you know, people were finally, you know, building, commercializing, figuring out the uses for classical computers. That was a very young area itself. And I mean, the entire theory of computational complexity, which, you know, is sort of an intellectual prerequisite to quantum computing, right? That only developed in the 1960s, right? You know, and then the theory of, you know, P and NP and NP completeness, that was only the 1970s, right? So now, you know, if we think about, you know, the people who could have combined these fields, I mean, I think of, you know, I think of John von Neumann as an obvious possibility, because he was, you know, of course, one of the great pioneers of both of computer science and of quantum mechanics, right? In fact, you know, he invented the notion of entropy of quantum states, mm-hmm. you know, and but, you know, he had a lot of other things on his plate, and then he died early. He died in the 50s, right? I mean, you know, Alan Turing was also, you know, of course, a founder of computer science, who was also passionately interested in the foundations of quantum mechanics. You know, as we know from his letters to his friends, you know, he died when he was 42.
Right.
So you know, whatever the case, you know, I feel like quantum mechanics and the theory of computing were both in place by the 1930s, but there was a lot of other stuff on people's plates. And, you know, the idea of, you know, thinking of entanglement as a resource, that only starts in the 60s. Computational complexity, that only starts in the 60s and 70s. And then, you know, maybe a decade after that, people start thinking about quantum computation.
Interesting. I've heard two other theories, and I want to see what you think of them. So the first one is, I think I might be misquoting him, but I think at some point David Deutsch said the reason he was able to think seriously about quantum computing was that he took the many worlds interpretation seriously, and because mm-hmm. people before him hadn't taken many worlds mm-hmm. seriously, mm-hmm. they hadn't been able to go quantum computing. And
yeah.
The second, sorry, go ahead.
Go on. Okay, should I respond to that one first?
Yeah.
Okay, so that is definitely true for Deutsch. Right. And I know, you know, Deutsch well, you know, and he actually, you know, became a big believer in the many worlds interpretation when he was here at UT Austin.
Right.
As a student, as you know, and he heard Hugh Everett himself give a lecture about it. Bryce DeWitt, who was, one of the main early proponents of the many worlds interpretation, was also here at UT Austin. And had a big role, had a big influence on Deutsch, and you know, and Deutsch was thinking about you know, how would you sort of make, you know, sort of shake people? How would you sort of make them realize that quantum mechanics is universally valid, that it applies at all scales? Well, you know, if you could build a computer, right, that you know, could do a superposition over of different computations, and then you could see the results of interference between them, right? That at that point, conceptually, it is almost like making a superposition over, you know, a brain that can think different thoughts, right? Yeah. And then, you know, if you could have that, then you know, the whole idea of that observers collapse the wave function just by being observers is no longer tenable. But so one problem is that Richard Feynman had the idea of quantum computing around the same time as Deutsch did. Right. And Feynman, I mean, he was certainly aware of the many worlds interpretation. He was aware of Everett, but that was not his motivation for thinking about quantum computing. He was, you know, as usual, he was much more practically focused. He was thinking about how do we simulate physics? You know, how do we simulate nature with a computer? And if we use classical computers, we suffer this exponential slowdown. Right. And so can we build a new kind of computer that will solve that problem and give us a universal quantum simulator? You know, I mean, people were there was also a whole movement in the 70s and 80s to think about the physics of computation, including like the thermodynamics of computation. Can you make computation inherently reversible? You know, and all kinds of other issues, right, that are not about, you know, exponential speed ups. But that was also one of the intellectual streams that sort of led directly to quantum computation, right? So I think that what you said is very much true for Deutsch, But, you know, there were others, you know, besides Deutsch who were thinking about these things. Feynman was only one. There were others as well. I think, you know, Benioff, you know, and several others. And, you know, few people in this field are as messianic as Deutsch is about the many worlds interpretation.
It's interesting that, come to think of it, that both Deutsch and Turing were trying to solve a separate philosophical problem when they came up with their model of computation, or at least in part. Okay, so the second theory I've heard is that since the 1970s, that academia has been less open to new ideas. And you mentioned Wisner, Everett, and both of them, I understand, were kind of, looked down, ostracized or something. Is that theory confirmed?
I think it is possible that in some parts of academia, you know, it has become harder to explore new ideas, you know, than it once was. You know, I could believe that about the social sciences. I could believe that, you know, about parts of medicine. You know, people used to do just completely crazy things, just, you know, invent some new concoction, inject themselves with it, you know, see what happens, you know, write an article about it, you know, whereas today, you know, it might take like $1 billion of investment before you could even get to the point where, you know, anyone would consider it remotely ethical to do such a thing, right? So on the other hand, in physics and speculation about foundations of computing and cosmology and things like that. I think if anything, things have gone in the opposite direction. And this is partly because we now have this preprint server, this archive, where everyone can post, you know, all of their new research ideas, you know, with no filter, right? And I think that is somewhat transformed the scientific landscape. Because I mean, we still have journals, but, you know, journals are now just like a final stamp of approval that, you know, in many fields is, yeah, I mean, it's important when you're looking for jobs or things like that. But journals are no longer gatekeepers to, you know, that can sort of prevent people from seeing your paper, right? Mm-hmm. And so you know, if you just look at the quantum physics, you know, archive every day, you will see so many far out ideas, right? It is so much crazy stuff that it's very hard to believe that a modern day Wiesner or Everett, you know, would feel any barrier to, you know, to getting their idea out there, right? I mean, today the problem is more that, like, there are so many, you know, bold new ideas that, you know, of course, you know, most of them won't go anywhere, right? Most of them will fail, right? And, you know, and so there's so much to sift through if you're, you know, looking for what is actually going to be revolutionary.
I'm sure your comments section and email fills up with these, but yeah. Have you, how many of the important ideas, or do many important ideas in the field come from people outside academia, or is it mostly people with PhDs working within the system?
Those are not exhaustive categories, right? Because, you know, there have been breakthroughs that have come from people who were not in academia. Very often what you find is that these are people who were sort of on the margin of academia. Like, they got a PhD and then they left, you know, the academic world, or they did part of a PhD or things like that, right? There was a famous case of Yitang Zhang, who was this mathematician from China, right, who proved that there are infinitely many pairs of primes, at most 70 million apart, right, which was, you know, a major advance in number theory, right? And this was a guy who had like he had gotten a PhD in math in China, I think, but then moved to the US and then worked making sandwiches at Subway. You know, in order to like support his family and you know, worked various other odd jobs, but you know, but continued working on math. I hear all the time from, you know, people who are like complete autodidacts, you know, who taught themselves ZS and you know, they think that they've solved the P versus NP problem or whatever, right? That is usually someone who just doesn't understand the question, who has just made some, you know, there is a distinction, because sometimes people, you know, who sort of teach themselves the field, they just, you know, they really want to learn. They just want an expert to talk to, you know, who will tell them like, here's where you're on the right track. Here's where, you know, you made a mistake, and they will thank you for that, right? Other times you get people who really dig in their heels, and you know, the establishment is censoring me, and I had when I taught at MIT, I had someone like writing to the president of MIT to try to get me fired. I had another one sending me death threats, because specific, you know, I had to actually contact the police about them, because I would not publish their, proof of P equals NP or their refutation of quantum computing on my blog, right? So you get the whole spectrum. The other thing you find is, there are, a lot of the readership of my blog comes from people who studied technical subjects in college, studied CS or math or physics, and then went out into industry, right? But maintain this connection, maintain their sort of curiosity about fundamental questions. And some of those people, actually want to continue to do research. And I'm actually co-authoring a paper with one of them right now. I posted this survey article about the busy beaver function on my blog recently. And, there was a, a hobbyist who solved some of the open problems.
Really?
That were on the survey. And and had a lot of new ideas. And he and I are going to write a paper about it now.
Oh, cool. Interesting. Yeah. But by the way, is that Shuang the same one that co-authored the Nielsen textbook on quantum information?
No. There's a Yitang Zhang, and then there's it was the mathematician, and then Isaac Chuang.
Oh, okay.
Is the physicist who co-authored the Nielsen Chuang textbook.
Okay, got it. My mistake. Yeah. So let me ask you about Busy Beaver. Sure. I was, is the proposition 3 was that you can't.
I have no memory for the numbering of propositions. So.
Okay. can you actually just explain what the Busy Beaver function is before I ask you these
questions? Yeah, okay, sure. So the Busy Beaver function is a really, really remarkable sequence of hyper rapidly growing integers. And the way that we define it, it was invented in 1962 by a mathematician named Tibor Rado. And basically what we do is we'd like to say, if I want to name the biggest number that I could possibly think to define, then why not just say, the biggest number that can be named using 1,000 words or fewer, okay, or something like that, right? But then I have to be careful, because there's an inherent paradox there, right? Which is, I also could have said like 1 plus the biggest number that can be named with 1,000 words or fewer, but then that I just named that with fewer than 1,000 words, right? And so so from this, the conclusion that logicians, philosophers drew more than 100 years ago is that the concept of naming a number, in English is not as clear as we think it is. right? It leads to paradox if you're not careful about it. But what if we could name a number in a way that was completely unambiguous? Well, you know, since Alan Turing in the 1930s, we've had such a way. That way is computer programs, right? Or Turing machines. And so we could say, think of the largest integer that can be generated by a computer program that is at most, let's say, 1,000 bits in length. Okay, and you know, now you have to be careful. What do you mean by that? Right? Because of course a computer program could run forever, right? It could start just, we could easily write a program that says do print nine loop, right? And it would just print an infinite sequence of nines. So what we do is we restrict attention to those computer programs that eventually hold, right? We say among, let's say for a given N, we consider all of the possible computer programs that are N bits long, and say there are 2 to the N power of them, or at most 2 to the N power, right? Many strings will just lead to things that are not even programs, you know, they won't even compile. So we'll throw those away, right? Now, among all of the valid N-bit programs, some of them run forever. We just run them on a blank input. So we throw those away as well. Right? We consider only the ones that eventually stop. And now, among all of the ones that stop, we take the one that runs for the longest number of steps, the largest number of steps until it stops. And that number of steps, that is what we call the nth busy beaver number.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? So, So the way that Rado defined this was using Turing machines, which is just one particular programming language, the one invented by Alan Turing in the 1930s. He said, busy beaver of N is the largest finite number of steps that any N state Turing machine can run for. Okay. And the amazing thing is one can prove that this function grows faster than any computable function. Okay, so no matter what sequence of integers, you know, you can if you are in a contest to name the largest number, and if you say busy beaver of 1,000, then you will utterly destroy any opponent who doesn't know about the busy beaver function or about anything similar to it. Okay. So, one can say further remarkable things about this function, like that, you know, only a finite number of values of the function can actually be proven from the axioms of set theory, right? For reasons of Gödel's incompleteness theorem, basically, after a certain finite point, you know, the values of this function, you know, presumably it has definite values. Right, because it's this clearly defined function, and yet we could no longer prove what they are. Okay, so right now only, you know, if you take the busy beaver function as Rado defined it in the 60s, only 4 values of the function are known. Okay, that busy beaver of 1 is 1, busy beaver of 2 is 6, busy beaver of 3 is 21, and busy beaver of 4 is 107. Busy beaver of 5, it is only known that it's at least 47 million, okay? You know, and we don't know how much bigger it might be. Busy beaver of 6, it's at least, I think, about 10 to the 36,000, okay? Might be much bigger. Busy beaver of 7, it's at least 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 18 million, you know, and might be enormously larger still. Okay, just to give people an idea of how this function grows.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I recommend everybody who's listening to check out the Busy Beaver Frontier paper, because it was written in such a way that I also want to ask you how you learned to write so well. It was written in such a way so that non-expert like me could understand it. And just to clarify from my own understanding, it's not that there isn't a function that for any n is greater than Busy Beaver of n. It's just that Busy Beaver will eventually be with more states than if you have
that's
to
right. I mean,
that function, it will grow
that
bigger.
That's exactly what I meant when I said grows faster than.
Right.
Right. I mean, each particular value of busy beaver is just some positive integer, right?
Yeah.
It's this very concrete thing, right? You know, like it's 6 or it's 21, right? But, you know, if you look at the rate of growth of these integers, right, it will dominate, eventually dominate any computable function.
Right.
And in practice, not just eventually, but very, very quickly.
Yeah. And you show very elegantly in the paper that that means you can independently prove the halting problem and Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
The unsolvability of the halting problem, Gödel's theorem, like these things are so intertwined that like there are many, many different way, you know, ways to prove them all, right? But the busy beaver function gives you one way that, yeah, you can prove that, you know, that you can use it to prove independently that there is an uncomputable function. You can use it to prove Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
Right. Okay. So my the proposition 3 was the one that said that for any axiomatic theory, you can't prove all of busy beaver with it.
Right.
But so my question was, can you keep, even though there's no systematic way to extend our set theory, is there plausibly a way that you can keep extending it such that you can prove higher and higher values of busy beaver?
That's a wonderful question. You know, I would say we don't really know yet, right? Because right now we can't even pin down busy beaver of 5. Okay. My guess would be that the resources of you know, existing set theory are perfectly enough to do that, right? But you know, we don't even know that, right? So 4 years ago, a student of mine named Adam Yedidia and I decided to, you know, look into a question that for some reason no one had looked at before, which was, what is the smallest n for which we can actually prove that the value of busy beaver of n is independent of set theory, right? Like, it was clear that there is some n for which mm-hmm. this is true, but are we talking about 10 million or are we talking about 10, right? So in practice, what this problem boils down to is almost like software engineering. Like, you have to construct a Turing machine that checks all of the theorems of set theory, and it halts only if it finds a contradiction, right? And you have to build such a Turing machine with as few states as possible. Mm-hmm. Right? You can build such a machine with only n states, then you've proven that that set theory cannot determine the value of busy beaver of n, because if it did, then it would thereby determine its own consistency, which is exactly what Gödel's theorem does not allow, right? So what we managed to do is we managed to find such a machine with 8,000 states, okay, about 8,000 states. You know, that was after a lot of optimization, right? And you know, a lot of coding and engineering and new ideas, right? Since then, a hobbyist, to come back to your earlier question, someone outside of academia by the name of Stefan O'Rear, has managed to improve our bound and got it to under 800 states.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is the current record. Now, if you could get that down to like, it is a wonderful question. Could you get it down to like 10 states or something like that, right? And, you know, that would tell us that we have to already go beyond the current axioms of set theory, you know, even to just get the next few values of the busy beaver function, right? But maybe not. Maybe you can even get 100 of them with existing set theory, right? We don't know. Now, what you can do is, at whatever point, you know, ZF set, Zermelo-Frankel set theory, you know, which is the accepted basis for you know, most of math, at whatever point it runs out of steam, which, you know, we don't know exactly where that point is, but one can then extend it by what are called large cardinal axioms, right, which basically assert that there exists an infinity that is bigger than any infinity that can be defined in ZF set theory, right? Or, you know, you can say, you know, where infinity is of various particular kinds, right? And and presumably one could then settle more values of the busy beaver function that way, right? But the issue is, you know, no matter what set theory you think of, right, as soon as you can build a Turing machine that enumerates all of the theorems of that set theory, then however many states there are in that Turing machine, that then sets a bound on how many busy beaver numbers right. that set theory can ever determine, yeah. right? So in some sense, the set theories that can determine more and more busy beaver numbers will have to become more and more complicated.
Right.
Right. Right. We know that. As you said, right, there will never be a systematic way to search for them, because if there were, then that would make the busy beaver function computable.
Right.
And what it means for there to be no systematic way to search is that, you know, we could keep like proposing more and more set theories. And if you look at modern, you know, mathematical logic, set theorists do this, right? They do propose more and more large cardinal axioms, but sometimes they actually discover that their axioms are inconsistent, right? Or, you know, they sort of provisionally, you know, adopt an axiom or use it, but the community is not really convinced that it won't lead to an inconsistency, right? So that, you know, there's no surefire way to think of these axioms and be confident that you actually still have a consistent system.
Okay, let me offer a very, very silly thought experiment. Okay, so this is inspired by that joke that if you shoot enough sunlight at the Earth, it'll shoot a Tesla back, right? Okay, so the idea is, if the Turing principle is true, you can simulate the Earth and the solar system and everything on a very incomprehensibly big computer, right? Mm-hmm. With all the humans on
given,
it.
Given the appropriate initial data.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. so yeah. Simulating all that is a computable function. And yeah. if you can check in like every 100 years and see what is the biggest busy beaver number that humans have proven this century, what is the biggest busy beaver number proved 100 centuries? Is that not a computable function where that tells you busy beaver of n indefinitely higher as long as?
It would give you a way to compute arbitrary values of the busy beaver function if humans were indeed to continue, you could say under the assumptions. That number one, you know, everything in our physical world is computable. I mean, you know, we let that you and I just let that assumption pass almost without comment, right? Although, you know, of course, that's an enormous question in itself, right? With some brilliant people like Penrose on the other side of that. But all right, but you know, and then. So assuming that everything we're doing is computable, and also assuming that we could somehow, you know, continue finding more and more values of the busy beaver function indefinitely, right? If that were true, then we would have a contradiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then either everything is the Turing principle is false, or we can't indefinitely keep extending.
Yeah, something. Yeah, you could say a very conservative way out would be to say, well, you know, our quest to compute more and more busy beaver numbers will come to an end.
Right. Okay, that's very interesting.
And you know, in fact, there has not been another busy beaver number determined since the early 1980s.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Which is when busy beaver 4 was pinned down.
Okay. So I'm looking forward to the paper you published with the hobbyists now.
Bruce Smith is his name.
Bruce Smith. Okay, very interesting. Okay, so let me ask you now. I remember in class last year you said, you know, that basically we have a few very important quantum algorithms like Grover's and Shor's that were discovered in the 90s, and now a lot of stuff now is just an extension of those algorithms. What do you think is the potential of finding, is there a good reason to think that there are other quantum algorithms to be discovered that are as fundamental and important as Grover's and Shor's were?
I would love it if there were, right? I'd be thrilled to, you know, discover such an algorithm, have one of my students discover it, right? You know, this is, you know, well, you know, I mean, that, I mean, that's the kind of discovery that we enter this field for, right? I mean, you know, you know, if we're being intellectually honest, you know, we have to admit that, you know, it's been 25 years since Grover's algorithm was discovered, right? And maybe no other quantum algorithm as fundamental as Shor's or Grover's has been discovered, you know, in the last 25 years. What we have discovered, you know, as you learned, because you took my class, was you know, a lot of, you know, an enormous number of generalizations and new applications and variations of Shor's and Grover's algorithms, you know, including what are called quantum walk algorithms, including you know, phase estimation based algorithms. You know, and some totally different quantum algorithms were also discovered, although, you know, the problems they solve are maybe more abstruse, right? Or, you know, hard, you know, it's harder to explain what problem they're solving. And, you know, so, you know, you could wonder, you know, is it lack of imagination on our part, or is it, you know, I mean, another possibility is, you know, if you look at the history of classical computer science, you know, what you find is that there are a few basic techniques that were discovered very early on in the history of classical CS. One of them is dynamic programming, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, dividing, you know, breaking down your problem like recursively into sub problems, right? I mean, you know, we could say, you know, in general, recursion, right? Solve, you know, divide and conquer, greedy algorithms, you know, convex programming, you know, linear programming, right. You know, Gaussian elimination, right? And you know, and most of the, you know, I mean, the field of classical algorithms is enormous. And yet, you know, most of the classical algorithms that we know are somehow built up out of these motifs that were discovered very early on, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't normally think of that as a failure of classical algorithms, right? We just think of it as, you know, there are these fundamental features of the algorithmic universe that, you know, that people noticed as soon as they started looking, right? And then you can go much further, but you go much further by building on the basic things that you have, right? And so maybe we should think of Shor's algorithm and Grover's algorithm not as just specific algorithms, but as sort of some of the basic design motifs of the world of quantum algorithms. Then, you know, it's not surprising that they were discovered very early on, just like dynamic programming was discovered, you know, right at the beginning of the history of classical algorithms.
Mm.
So, you know, so, you know, I mean, that's one point of view. Now, another point of view is, you know, if like when people ask for more quantum algorithms, or, you know, they'll say they hold us to account for our failure to discover more quantum algorithms. You know, I like to answer that question with another question, which is, well, what are the problems that you would like these algorithms for, right? And amazingly, that question almost always stops, you know, the asker, right? Because like they didn't even, you know, because no matter what problem they name, you know, there's an excellent chance that people in quantum algorithms have thought about it, you know, and we know, you know, something about how much speed up you can get from a Grover type algorithm, you know, but we have good reasons to think that you're not going to be able to get better than that. Or, you know, I mean, or, you know, we say, well, maybe there's like, if in the case of the graph isomorphism problem, yeah, sure, maybe there's a polynomial time quantum algorithm, but probably just because there's a polynomial time classical algorithm, right? And that, you know, and it's that that hasn't been discovered yet, right? Although, you know, there's been major progress toward it. You know, no matter what problem they name, right? I mean, probably someone has studied it in the context of quantum algorithms, and I could then tell them for that problem, you know, exactly what is the current situation, and, you know, what are people stuck on? You know, and so it might be that if we want to discover fundamentally new quantum algorithms, that the way to do it will be to realize fundamentally new problems, right? Problems that people hadn't even thought about designing an algorithm for, you know, previously, right? You know, the way, you know, another thing, you know, another way that I like to put it is, you know, like in any, you know, in any given area of math or science, right, there is this phenomenon of low-hanging fruit that gets picked very, very early on, right? And then those of us who come into the field a little bit later have to leap higher, you know, if we want to find any fruit, right? But the, you know, I think the ultimate solution to the problem of low-hanging fruit being picked is to find a new orchard, you know? and so you know, figure out what are, you know, potential problems that quantum computers could solve that no one has been thinking about before. You know, maybe people actually starting to get quantum computers, as they finally are today, that they can experiment with, will help stimulate the discovery of those, you know, new problems or new applications.
Just like with Grover's algorithm, is there some reason to expect that from first principles, there are other algorithms that can be solved by quantum algorithms?
Yeah, so it is, you know, like anything where it's sort of as basic as Grover's algorithm, that you just look at, you know, the way that amplitudes are changing over time and think that an algorithm is going to exist, right? That probably would have been snapped up by now, just because quantum algorithms have become so much more sophisticated. Compared to what they were 25 years ago, okay? But there are some problems where there's some evidence that a quantum algorithm might exist, even though we don't yet know it, if it does exist. A good example is computing the edit distance between two strings, right? Which means the minimum number of insertions and deletions and changes that I have to make to change one string to another string. This is a fundamental problem for a DNA sequence alignment, for example. The best known algorithm for it takes quadratic time. It's based on dynamic programming, in fact. And you know, there is some evidence that there might be a quantum algorithm that would take n to the 3/2 time or something like that. But if so, it has not yet been discovered. Mm. So there are cases like that. No.
Gotcha. Okay. The next question I wanted to ask you was, why do many of the important discoveries, not just in this field, but in many other fields, come from closely communicating groups of collaborators or people within such groups? You said on Sean Carroll's podcast that Shore and Grover were collaborators at Bell Labs.
Well, I'm not sure that they actually were collaborators. I mean, they worked in the same building, I believe. You know, I think they I think the discovery of Shor's algorithm created a lot of excitement, you know, all over the place, but certainly at Bell Labs, which is where Shor was, right? And I think that Grover, who worked also at Bell Labs, but in a completely different department, I think he was affected by that excitement. And, I'm not even sure if they knew each other prior to Grover's discovery of Grover's algorithm. Okay. But I could ask them that. But but you know, I mean, more broadly, you know, it is certainly true that in the history of ideas, like, you know, major innovations seem to come in clusters all the time. Bell Labs was a huge example of that, right? I mean, the Shor's and Grover's algorithms were really, really at the tail end, right, of, you know, the heyday of Bell Labs, right, which was mostly the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, right? But I mean, you know, you had the invention of the transistor, you know, of the communication satellite, and so many other things, right, from this one place. Another example would be you know, I mean, we could take Athens and the ancient world, right? We could take Florence. We could look at a Cambridge University, right? Let's say, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, right? That had just so many mathematicians, economists, philosophers, physicists who revolutionized the world. Now, this might be because, you know, something about the environment, right? That, you know, ideas bounce off of each other, right? People see something, they see someone achieve something spectacular and they're either, you know, inspired by that, or they view it as a challenge. You know, they want to compete against that and come up with their own thing, right? You know, a Silicon Valley, of course, you know, would be another big example, although more for technology than for science, right? So that would be one explanation. And a different explanation would be that, you know, these certain places at certain points in time just, you know, attract all of the people who you know, maybe anyway would have had these great ideas, but, you know, that kind of person wants to go to these, you know, these centers, you know, wherever they are. And so these centers will just collect the kind of people who are likely to discover these things.
Right. Correlation doesn't equal causation in this case. Okay. Let me ask you now, I've interviewed a lot of economists on this podcast. I think this question will be interesting to the listeners. Uh-huh. In your paper on why philosophers should care about complexity, you talk about how the difficulty in finding Nash equilibrium might be relevant to discussions on economics. Can you explain? Can you explain this?
Yeah. Okay. So there was a big advance in theoretical computer science 14 years ago, when theoretical evidence was finally discovered for why computing a Nash equilibrium is a hard problem, basically. And this confirmed a suspicion that people had had for a long time, right? Because, you know, if we look at a von Neumann equilibrium, right, which is like an equilibrium of a two-player zero-sum game, right? Then, you know, this can be found easily, you know, using linear programming, okay? But a Nash equilibrium is somehow a more complicated beast, right? And it's the way that Nash proved that they exist in the 50s was using the what's called the Kakutani fixed point theorem, right? It's some fixed point theorem from topology. And if you try to actually unwind the existence proof into an actual algorithm to calculate the equilibrium, then what you get is an algorithm that ends up taking exponential time, right? It eventually hits the equilibrium, but it may have to follow an exponentially long trail before it reaches it. If you're interested in this, the best things that have been written about it, I think, are by Christos Papadimitriou. And Papadimitriou was one of the discoverers in 2006, along with Goldberg and Daskalakis, of this hardness theorem, which, you know, it doesn't prove that it's hard to find a Nash equilibrium, and it doesn't even prove that it's NP hard. This problem kind of doesn't have the right structure to be an NP complete problem. Just because of Nash's theorem that tells us that a Nash equilibrium always exists, right? Like, in order to be NP complete in any way that we currently understand, there has to be a decision problem. You know, is there a solution or is there not a solution, right? But for finding a Nash equilibrium, there always is a solution, right? There's only the problem of how to find it. But what was shown is that basically finding a Nash equilibrium is at least as hard as any other problem for which, you know, a solution is guaranteed to exist because of the same kinds of principles.
Okay.
So it is complete for that complexity class of problems for which, you know, a solution is guaranteed to exist for this sort of reason. So, you know, what does this mean for economics? Yes. Well, it's not clear, right, if it has a sort of direct implication, but it fits into this general narrative of, just because an equilibrium exists, that's not the end of the story, right? I mean, if the market can't actually find the equilibrium, right, in any, or we could say, if calculating this equilibrium would take exponential time, then we shouldn't expect the market to be able to find it either. Right. And so, now economists are well aware, right, that there are these issues, right, that people are not perfectly rational, even if they want to be perfectly rational, which they don't always, being perfectly rational might involve computations that they're just not able to do. Right. And they've with varying degrees of success, they've tried to account for such phenomena. But, I would say, the Nash equilibria are so central to economic theory, right, that, the hardness of finding Nash equilibria, I think, is a, maybe a non-trivial result, underscoring that general point.
That's incredibly interesting. But do you think Hayek's knowledge problem, or the way he phrased it, might be related to complexity as well? So in terms of like central planning, in order to satisfy some constraints set by bureaucrats, might be like an NP-complete problem where it's like,
well, I want to separate two different things, right? One is lack of knowledge, right, about what is going on in the economy, so forth. And the other one is lack of ability to do computations on the knowledge that you have, right? Mm. So the hardness of Nash equilibria is talking about the latter issue.
Right? Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I mean, they're related in a way, right? They're both, they're both different kinds of deviations from perfect omniscience, right? But they're different kinds of deviations from omniscience. And, in theoretical computer science, very, very often we have to distinguish them. Often like people will ask me if some problem is or isn't NP complete when, what they really mean is like, how hard is it to collect the information, right? Which is, it's kind of like apples and oranges. It's a category mistake, right? To even talk about whether a problem is in P or is in NP or whatever, we assume that an input is given to you, right? So all of the information that you need, you have it in front of you. And then, we are exclusively concerned with the difficulty of calculating something about that information, right? Now there is also, the difficulty that, people who are in, economic actors, don't have the information that they need, or certainly central planners, don't have the information that they need, right? And there actually is a whole subfield of economics, that's the economics of information, right? How much do you pay to learn something about, what is going on, or how do you design an auction in a way that you elicit the information that you want from the participants in the auction and things like that. I think that economists maybe have an easier time dealing with those things, or that stuff has been better integrated into economics than the computational considerations have been.
Okay, that's incredibly interesting. Just a few more questions.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, I'm going to bring us back to David Deutsch and creativity.
Okay.
In the Ask Me Anything chapter of Quantum Computing Since Democritus, you have a student ask you what complexity class is creativity in? And you say, part of what you say is, we've got a billion years of natural selection giving us a very good toolbox of heuristics of solving certain kinds of search problems, like problems in NP. But that makes it kind of sound like we have more heuristics to solve these problems than chimpanzees do. Chimpanzees have more than ants. I don't know if this is how you meant it, but do you see like the algorithm for creativity as a thing you have or you don't have? Or is it like you just have better heuristics for searching through different
complexity classes? I don't know that there is such a thing as the algorithm for creativity, right? In fact, the phrase is almost oxymoronic, right? that if there were such an algorithm, well, then whatever it output would no longer be creative, would it? Because it would just be the output of that algorithm, right?
Yeah.
I think that, it seems like there is such a thing as, you know, general purpose reasoning ability or general purpose ability to invent creative solutions to problems, which, let's say, Einstein had more of than some random person off the street, but the random person off the street has more of than a chimpanzee, and a chimpanzee has more of than an ant. But it is somehow very, very hard to articulate what we mean by that, you know, in a way that would actually support these, you know, comparisons across, you know, vastly different evolutionary histories and goals in life and all these things.
Do you, from the beginning to infinity, do you buy David Deutsch's term, a universal explainer, that people are universal explainers, AIs will be universal explainers, but non-human animals aren't, and that's like the only demarcation that matters?
I think Deutsch is like, he's incredibly optimistic and also incredibly categorical in his thinking, right? You know, I don't know anyone else who is sort of as optimistic or, you know, and hardly anyone else who is as black and white, right? It does seem likely that there is some kind of threshold that you cross in going from a chimpanzee to a human, right? Where like, yes, a chimpanzee is smarter than a cow, right? But like, you know, if you stare at both of them, you know, it doesn't seem like, you know, the chimpanzee is noticeably closer than the cow is to, you know, being able to land on the moon, right? Or proof from Moslet's theorem, right? Or any of these things, right? And with humans, you know, you had like in succession, you had, you know, a few, you know, extremely important milestones that, you know, that had not been crossed before in the animal kingdom, right? You have universality of language, right? The ability to have a recursive language that can sort of express thoughts of, you know, unbounded complexity. You had the invention of writing, you know, the ability to transmit those thoughts across generations. A number system that could refer to arbitrarily large numbers, you know, and then, you know, computers, you know, which are universal machines, right? The ability to build these kinds of machines. And, you know, and all of this went along with, you know, being able to explain the world around us in explicit theories, you know, to an extent that no animal species, you know, no other animal species was ever able to do. Having said that, you know, I don't actually know if people are universal explainers. That is, you know, I have no idea if we can explain everything, or even if we can explain everything that is explainable. I hope that we will continue being able to explain a lot more than we can explain right now, right? But I mean, you know, Deutsch, you know, uses words in unusual ways. Like when he talks about why he is so optimistic, you know, part of his optimism is like, you know, when he uses the word people, he also includes extraterrestrials, right? So he says like, oh yeah, you know, it's possible that humans on Earth will just all kill themselves out. You know, there will be a nuclear war or an environmental catastrophe, but that's not a big deal because people in the broader sense of, you know, life elsewhere in the universe will go and do all of the amazing things anyway that we would have done. I mean, that may be called comfort to most of us here on Earth, right? And so when he says something like people are universal explainers, you know, you always have to press him on, you know, not only what does he mean by a universal explainer, but even what does he mean by people?
Right. His claim on the universal explainer part is that just as many worlds is the most parsimonious way to describe quantum mechanics, so you don't have to like postulate an arbitrary collapse. Since we have no reason to expect since we have no proof that there are things we cannot explain, the most parsimonious explanation is that we can explain everything.
Okay, I don't know. I mean, you know, there are certain questions like the hard problem of consciousness, let's say, or the question of why is there a universe at all, where, you know, it's not just that we don't have an explanation, it's that the mind sort of spins in circles when we try to contemplate what could possibly consist of an explanation, right? What could an explanation possibly look like, even in principle, right? That could just be a lack of imagination, right? But, you know, it could be that there are, you know, I mean, like we all know, you know, the two-year-old who just, you know, you asks why, and then you tell them and they ask why, and you tell them and, you know, and they ask why. And, you know, after, you know, a half dozen whys, you know, you're all the way back at the Big Bang, right? You know, you're back at, the beginning of the universe, and you know, they continue asking why, right? And it could be that, you know, there are questions with the property that, you know, that every first of all, you know, I think even Deutsch thinks that we will not, you know, that there is no one time where we'll have an explanation of everything, right? Because because Deutsch, you know, says that each question that we answer will lead to further questions, right? You know, each time you explain something, you know, there's then the question of, you know, whatever the explanation is based on, you know, why is that, right? So just like that two-year-old, right, we can always dig deeper and deeper. Okay, but now, you know, just to loop back to earlier in this conversation, like if we think about the busy beaver function, right, we know that, you know, it's not just that, you know, like you need more and more resources to compute more and more values of the busy beaver function, and so you'll never know all of them. It's that there are fixed values, like busy beaver of 800, right, where the existing axioms of set theory, you know, provably will not suffice to let you determine that, right? And so likewise, for all I know, there could be fixed questions where, you know, maybe the hard problem of consciousness, maybe why is there a universe, where what we currently consider to be an explanation just will not suffice to ever explain these things. Right. But I don't know. I feel like unlike Deutsch, you know, I don't want to assert that I know the answer from first principles. I want to continue looking for explanations of these things. It can be, when you're searching for explanations, you know, it can be psychologically helpful to, you know, assume that the explanation exists. Let's not make that into more than it is, right? Let's not take a useful heuristic and elevate it into a basic principle of reality.
Right. But on this point, Deutsch wrote a book in called The Fabric of Reality, where he talks about how Gödel's incompleteness theorem actually verifies the importance of creativity, so that if we need to come up with new axioms to prove busy beaver of 800, that's the entire point of creativity. And as far as, like, I think he thinks the hard problem of consciousness can be solved, but even if it can't be solved, like, the reason it's so hard is not because it's not an artifact of our mind. It just seems like we can't imagine a possible mind. And that might itself be an artifact of our mind. We can't imagine a possible way that you could solve it, regardless of what kind of mind you had. The final question is, what advice would you give to a 20-year-old who's interested in technical subjects? Maybe he's not doing a PhD program like you were at the time, but just in college, interested in technical subjects.
just learn all that you can. I mean, you know, there has never been a time when sort of more resources were available to anyone who wants to learn things. So take courses, talk to your professors, go on the internet and, read books, delve deeply into a subject and you might be surprised at sort of how low the barriers sometimes are, right? That like if let's say that it was quantum computing that you were interested in, right? It doesn't have to be, it could be anything else. But if the entire literature of quantum computing pretty much is available for free on archive.org. And, if you go and like look every night at the new quantum computing papers that come out and just flag the ones that are interesting to you and read them, each paper will raise new questions that the authors don't know the answer to or yet. And sometimes they'll be explicitly listed in an open problem section. Other times, there'll be ones that you could think of. And you can study those problems. If you have ideas about them, you can, talk to the authors of the paper. It might take years or decades to become, an expert, like in a whole field, and you might be very far from that, but it really doesn't take that long to become the world expert on one particular tiny little problem, right? And so try to, become the world expert on something, even something very, very narrow, right? And once you've done that, then you can, write an article about it or, do a project about it. And then, that will lead to more things, right? It will lead to, maybe collaborations in the future, and it will lead to, you can then try to become an expert on something a little bit wider and so on.
Yeah, that's very excellent advice. I love that. Okay. Well, Professor Aaron, thank you so much for your time. Hey. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider sharing it with your friends and posting it on social media. Word of mouth is incredibly valuable for a new and a small podcast like this one. So thanks for watching.